Welcome to The Great Security Debate. This show has experts taking sides to help broaden understanding of a topic. Therefore, it's safe to say that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the people we work with or for. Heck, they may not even represent our own views as we take a position for the sake of the debate. Our website is greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can contact us via email at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter at securitydebate. Now, let's join the debate already in progress.
That video where it has that excavator holding an airplane.
Oh, and the flyer out. Yeah.
No.
It's
so great. We'll send it to you. Yeah, this is a great one for the show notes. And it's like, you know, when the customer really wants to see, you know, a demo, but there's no product put together yet.
Yes.
And it shows the excavator holding the airplane and it's spinning in circles as if it's flying.
Oh, nice.
It's a great shot at a lot of vendors, you know, based on some of the tape that people talk about. But no, what I was referring to in terms of, you know, relatability, and Eric, I don't want to speak from the practitioner side, and Dan, but let's say you come into a new organization, you're coming in there to build, right? You have some targets that have kind of been given to you right out the gate, and you don't really have a team there, or the people that are on the team in the first month, you realize like, hey, I'm probably going to need either a few more highly skilled or highly technical people, or I need someone that specializes in just this. So you start to bring in your outside team. In the vendor world, you know, and I can't sit here and say that like I'm the know-all be-all, since I've only been in the vendor world for about 4 years.
But to be fair, that's 30 years in normal human years.
Oh, no, absolutely. Thank you. I appreciate that. Hence I should get rid of that spotlight above me because it looks like my hair is falling out, but that's what happens in 4 years of working for a vendor.
I thought it was just the halo over your head.
Halo. So,
welcome to our all ADD episode today.
What were we talking about again?
Oh. We're talking about vendor dog years.
Literally. But when you get vendors that are trying to scale or they're going through, quote, hyper growth, you bring in a sales leader and he's given a target, like, here's what we got to do by the end of the year, right? Here's how much we have to grow. It's not, here's what we're going to do for the customer. It's here's how much we are going to grow. And there's a number given. So let's just say they want to go from 10 million to 30 million or 30 million to 60, right? Pick the number. But you pick that number and they look at it and say, okay, then we need each salesperson to do this amount of sales. And if we only have 5 sales guys, then they're doing millions of dollars, which means we got to go out and hire 50 sales guys and each of them have to do $1 million.
Right. People.
Right.
People. Sorry. I totally let myself down there. We got to go out and get 50 people. And in doing so, what do? You turn to those that you know, you bring in a few sales directors and say, hey, we need to hire this many people and here's our runway. You got 3 months to hire because by the end of the year, we have to hit this number. So a lot of times they go out and hire people that they know only because it shortens the length of the interview process, the HR process, the recruitment process, and hopefully with the experience that they've had with these people before, that these people are going to go out and just be able to sell. I think there's a little bit that gets lost in the culture that was being built when you bring in a new team, especially one where the entire sales organization ends up coming from one or two locations, right? So like that initial startup culture that you had where the team was all working together, somewhat gets lost. And I feel I saw that, you know, only because I worked at a company for 3 years, the initial startup culture, then the initial big growth, right? And the culture kind of remained pretty intact. And then you saw that start to shift as you start to grow, because that next level of growth where you have to double again is like twice the number of people that were hired the time before, right? And that's where things really, really begin to change.
So in 40 seconds there, Brian described like 19 different topics I want to talk about. Where to start?
It was one of those the deck, though? Or what, no, too far back.
Yeah. So, I mean, the overarching theme that I heard there is, you know, the bring in your own, or grow organically, or from within. There's kind of three paths, right? Take the people that are there and continue to grow them and nurture them into the role as needed. And I think this applies not just in that second phase of companies. I think this applies to any time you have new leadership. You have a new president of a university. They oftentimes bring in their own CFO, their own CIO, their own, you know, suite of people. And then those people bring in their suite of people. And so you start to, it doesn't just have to be at times of high growth in an organization. But I think that is a time in which you see a pretty dramatic shift.
Right. But, and nor is it unique path to business either, right? You see this in the coaching world, in sports all the time.
Oh, yeah.
New coach brings in the whole new cast behind him.
Well, yeah. Harbaugh comes to town and half the city changes. So it's a path one. You grow them within, take the people within, grow. You're new, you grow them, you nurture them, you evaluate them, you raise them, and you build the team you need from them. Path two is bring in the people you've worked with before, have been successful with before, know that you can trust, or that they're autonomous, you know their capabilities right off the bat, hit the ground running. Three, go outside, put up an open hire. See who applies. See who you may not know. Look at the people you've never seen before, that aren't internal, aren't new, known to you, and are now the new. All three have, you know, pretty interesting paths associated with them. But I want to, before I dive into those, I want to unpack one thing that you said around the cultures, like phases of culture in an organization, especially at that growth period. And I think you're right. I think there's and Eric, I think it's someone you work with who also made this point to me a few years ago. The idea that there are these arcs of how an organization lives, and the things you do in the beginning and the people types you need at the beginning are very different than those that you need in maturation, getting to maturity, and very different from those that you need when you are mature. Right. And there are some pretty wholesale changes in staffing that happen at the peaks of each of those as you move to the next arc of growth. And so I think there's some of that that goes along with the description that Brian made. So I think there's a couple of things in there, and I want to make sure we tease them out and look at them different. But let's start with, you're a new CISO, you're a new director of sales, you're a new CFO. Come into an organization. What are the pros and cons of bringing your own team in right from the beginning?
The pros and cons?
You take the pro, Eric. You take the con, Brian.
I'll take the pro. So bringing in your own team. So this goes back to, I look at this, what are the goals of the organization? What's the time horizon that we're trying to shoot for? Is this kind of there's an immediate risk, you need a turnaround job, you got to go right now. That you would make the argument that you're coming into, I guess for the sake of argument, you're coming into a lapsed security maturity framework, or, you know, the organization isn't doing well in that realm, and you got to turn it around quickly. I think the pro there, you bring in your own team, you guys, the team is already used to working with each other, that you can hit the ground running. So I guess I can't say the cons of that. I got to save that for Brian. Well, but I think from my perspective, that's the benefit right there. It's the speed to market, right? That you're already used to. Now, I'm not making the argument that you're going to hit the mark, because I think there's an intrinsic risk of bringing a whole new team in that pushes out the legacy players. I don't want to call them legacy players, but the incumbents that are already there, that you'll lose some of the history behind the organization and what's going on. So you definitely run that risk, but I think you've got a team that's already gelled together. You're calling in the special forces to come in and make a change really quickly.
So I don't know that I'm going to start 100% with the con, because it's going to sound like it's somewhat of a positive, right? But a negative to bringing in your own team because I'm going to flip it on its head here. The negative to bringing in your own team, and this comes from the sales side of it also, when you bring in your own team, the culpability is kind of 100% on you. So whereas if you had the team that was there before, as things are happening right over the first year, it's, well, listen, I wanted to bring in my own team, these guys, but this is what I had. So you're still resting the blame on either the previous organization or the previous management, right? And I see that the same in the sales side, where it's like you bring in a few guys, but the ones, you know, if they're hitting their number and the old guys are not, it's like, listen, I would have met my targets, but I was left with this. And you told me we needed to see if this works and it didn't.
So this is a con. What you're saying, this is a con because it lets people off the hook.
Somewhat, yeah.
Okay. And or attempts to lead people off.
Attempts the hook. To. And I think from a leadership side, because we've talked about this before, is sometimes you got to find the weaknesses in each person, right? And the strengths and what things you focus on in each person are going to be different, right? Because, you know, you could have someone that just doesn't want to sell, right? But typically if you have somebody in security and they've been there for a while, it's because they want to be in security. So find the strengths, because maybe they're just working in the wrong group or the wrong team, or maybe they just felt like they haven't had their voice. And then you come in, you don't allow them to have their voice, probably never going to find it under you, right? So I think there's some of that where a leader can come in, and from a con standpoint, there's a fallback there
there's a fallback if you're using the team that's already there.
Right.
That's a great thought. Yeah.
So, and also as a con though, of bringing in your own team, if there was good culture that was there and you're just coming in to level it up, when you come in and bring your own team in, I truly do believe the culture is going to change. Right. And sometimes the people that are not part of the team you brought in look around and they're like, man, I'm not part of that crew anymore, right? You could all work virtually, but they still don't feel like they get to go to the coffee station with you because you guys have your own sidebar conversations, or you're sitting in a meeting and they're like, no, what we talked about last night. And you realize, well, I wasn't part of that conversation last night, right? Because the team that you brought in has worked
together anyway beforehand and had continued to do so at the expense of the others. But the other is the idea that there's this whole race to effectiveness means oftentimes that people that come in and do this don't evaluate the people that are there. Don't actually do what you just said and say, you know, take into account the people that are already there, understand them. It's just wipe them out, we'll bring in what we know. And I think between that and not considering, you know, we talk a good game, the three of us in this, we talk a good game about wanting to bring new people into the field, wanting to give underrepresented groups and a better chance of getting into these roles. And I think bringing the people over that have already found success leaves out the opportunity to bring someone into some of those roles. And that one is a big one to me that I consider before I bring somebody over directly.
Well, and I think if you take a step back and look at it from a leadership perspective, I also think that you run the risk of, so we did the talk at MCWT, the live podcast that we did, and it was all under the premise of what got us here won't get us there, right? Yep. But if you continually take the same group to every place that you go, you run that risk. Exactly. That you are going counter to the idea of past results are not indicative of the future, right? And that is a dangerous premise. And to your point, you do leave out that you're not doing an assessment of the team that's already there, missing the skill sets that could already be present within the organization.
You know, it's funny that you bring up what we did at MCWT, because I literally was just on a call earlier this week, and I won't name the name of the OE, but one of the OEs was losing somebody on their team, and the conversation I had with someone was like, man, this is a huge loss for us. Like, this person really knows this group. They've been there for a while. I'm like, why are they leaving? They're like, well, technically they're a temp. They couldn't get hired full time because they don't have a degree, but they have all these different certifications. They've been doing the job for like 5-10 years. And I was like, when they said 5-10 years, I was like, so was it 5 or was it 10? And they're like, I think it was like 8 or 9 years. I was like, wow. That's not a little bit of time, right? Like, you see people that have worked for 2-3 years leave, right? But someone that's been there that long, they've proven themselves. And to hear from someone else in the organization who's like, this is just, it's so sad because this is somebody that really is going to make an impact by leaving, and we should find a way to keep them.
And it sounds like it's because of a quite antiquated rule if it's just about degrees.
Correct.
Yeah.
So in, one other thing I was going to say too, when you look at the team members that are already in place, and I'm saying this from personal experience, when new management comes in and you have, you're reporting to a new manager or a new director or a new VP, right? The conversation, Dan, that you just had about, do you sit down with each person, talk to them, figure out how they feel, how things are going, what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are, try to get to know them on a personal level. One thing you should also do is really let them know that I'm having this conversation with you though, because I still believe that you're important to the team and I still want you on the team and you are safe. I want you to know you're safe. Because if you don't have that conversation with them, like, remember the what people do when they fear, right? Like, that leads to that self-preservation thing.
Right.
And self-preservation leads to you making decisions for yourself and not the team. And there were several times I felt that when somebody came in brand new and literally across the table, it was like, man, he's asking some really interesting questions. But at no point has he ever said like, hey, I really like your past results. Hey, you're important. Hey, you're safe. I want you as part of my team. And then when changes occurred, it was like, are they getting rid of me? Do they like me? Like, am I a part of this anymore?
Wait, you're talking about effective managerial communication, Brian?
Exactly.
Proactive and ongoing?
But I think that's anywhere you go. So Eric, if you walked into a new team, right? And you had a similar experience, I would imagine, when you first came to American Axle, when you showed up there, you have a team of people in place. And the first part of getting to know the strengths of each person is talking to them, right? And how you communicate and communication. And actually, I don't want, Dan, I'm not trying to steer this, but I literally just had a conversation with someone that was like, you know what? Why is communication not something that's taught when we're going through grade school or going through high school?
That because the people who run grade schools and high schools are the worst communicators of them all, as experienced by a local district and the lead up to the start of school. I'll just leave it at that. Those, they don't teach it.
I'm hearing a story.
They don't know
it.
So this was a great, this conversation stemmed from something that was on LinkedIn that a CEO wrote and said that looking back on his career, the two things that he wished he would have worked harder at was communication and public speaking. And people were like, you're a great public speaker. And he goes, for one, I've never felt that way. And it took a very, very, very long time to get there. He goes, but I look back at what I was taught in grade school. He goes, we had different dancing courses. I forget the one that he said was mandatory. He goes, but communication never was. And he goes, if there's one thing that is so important, both from parents to children, from teachers to children, right? From your boss, from your ability to talk to even the board, it's communication, right?
Right.
And those are those soft skills that we talk about, but maybe communication isn't a soft skill. It's a life skill.
It's a core skill. Yeah. And it's funny, in MentorCore, we had this could come up a couple of times, the idea that soft skills, that the term soft skills can denigrate the value of those kinds of things. And words matter. You know, we're talking about communication. Soft skills aren't actually soft. Soft skills are core. They're critical. They are the basis for everything.
Connecting with people.
In the same way, I am long guilty of calling non-engineering sciences the soft sciences, but they're not. They're, you know, life sciences, biology, and others are just as, you know, just as core. So
I totally agree though. And I think if we take a step back and pull ourselves out of just looking at security and just look at leadership in general, though, I think we see this play out all the time where this lack of communication, look at acquisitions that happen, right? That acquisitions, you buy a company, look at it just for the numbers. All right, we got to cut X number of the workforce for the company that we're acquiring. And what happens after that? More
you
often
cry
than
on
not,
LinkedIn.
Yeah, more often than not that you realize, oh crap, everybody that actually had all of the knowledge from the company we just acquired just got cut. And now were playing from a deficit, right? Because you shifted from people to just being a numbers game. And I love, there was a quote from, I think it was Steve Jobs, that was talking about this when, I think it was just before he passed and he was doing a bunch of writing, that talked about there's a difference between being human and being a human. And it's a huge, huge difference. And I think that's from a leadership perspective, that's one of the things that we need to focus on. And the core of being a human is communicating and connecting with people at the root level. And Brian, to your point, just having that conversation. And there, it's interesting. So I figured, since I'm going to do a couple more quotes here, got through a couple more books. And one of them was, I think it was Power Moves by Adam Grant, which was really cool. It was a different style. If you read it on Audible, that rather than just being reading a book, it was actually live interviews that he was doing with some of the most, I mean, Satya Nadella, it was a lot of prominent people. And it was one of the things I think it was from this book that he was debunking, is the old notion of power tends to corrupt, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And it was making the argument, power in and of itself doesn't corrupt. All it does is bring to the surface what was already there. So I think if we look at that and change that lens, rather than being on a single person, but look at an organization, I think this is where you get that shift. And Brian, as you were talking about losing that culture, it's what do they really care about? And when you start to tease away and realize that the only thing that they care about is the revenue stream and growth and hitting some number, that's when you start to lose the scalability, you lose the culture, and you end up running into a brick wall because you've lost everything that made you great, which is interesting. So I'll add another book in there. Now I'll wait for Dan to come back and add it to the show notes. So
I'm good. We're good.
All right. So there was another book that I finished, Small Giants by Bo Burlingham. Awesome. So it was going through small companies that made the honest decision that they didn't want to become huge, that they were giants in their own realm, but they didn't want to go public. So actually, so Dan, this will hit home for you. Zingerman's was one of the ones that was in the case study. But it was interesting that they identified what made them great as a company. And a lot of times it was the culture. It was the way they did things, the way they connected with their employees, the way they connected with their customer base, that they recognized that if they were to scale at mass, that they were going to lose that and they would lose who they were and ultimately would veer off course and become just another commodity company out there like everybody else. But they made that honest decision. And I think that's one of the things from a leadership perspective that we have to keep in the back of our mind, because at the core of everything great is people.
This goes when you go back to the con part, Eric, I'm going to take a look at that Small Giants, because the Zingerman's reference is so interesting. And their model is based on transparency for each employee. You can see how you did the month before, the 2 months before, the quarter before, in actual metrics. Like here's why we're saying, guys, that we need to be careful, like how much we're throwing away, right? Because here's what our overall loss was in waste or in this, right? And when people talk about it, it's like, or when you say like, hey, we're going to start having a few cutbacks, right? It's like, oh, management's just trying to make more profit, right? But at Zingerman's, it was here's why we're doing it, and here's the areas where we were actually losing. You know, any input is great input, and that way team members could be like, well, actually, this is why it might have been higher because this happened, et cetera. So that's all great. But another, when you go back to Khan, because this was talking about the culture of bringing in your own team, right? That time period when you were talking about metrics, right, in revenue. And I kind of sent that note over last night, and I'll try to find where I found the actual write-up on it. But talking about tide, only when the tide goes out do you discover who's been swimming naked. And that was quoted by Warren Buffett. Because relying strictly on revenue metrics can hide the actual performance of your team. So, and again, it goes back, because you might have been brought in as a new CISO to a company because they're growing. Right. And now it's, hey, we need this role. It's not that the company had bad culture, was doing things poorly. They're just growing. Or you may be coming into a company because they just had a breach. Right. So you come on in and you're part of the investigation, but also what do we need to do next? How you handle that is going to define the culture of the company for the next X number of years. Because you can come in as General Eric Willie, right? Do the investigation and say, and what I see here is incompetence. I'm going to bring in the A team and they can all start next week. Everybody else take notes from the A team. What's the A team? You know, what's the other team going to do? They're immediately like, I'm not wanted here. Right.
Right.
How that's handled, right? And the circumstances of why a new CISO comes in vary from organization to organization. The previous CISO might have just left after building up a great team, right? And the second you come in, you could have people that, well, I need to try to make this my own. I need to do things a little bit different so it's me and not the previous person, right? So you're trying to change things just because of that. Egos aside, you're still there to help take care of people and the organization.
So what I'm hearing from you then, it's not just about what you accomplish, but how you accomplish it that matters. The journey is very important in how you get there.
Absolutely. So bringing in your own team, maybe it's a good thing because you need more heads, right? How you bring them in, though, is the most important thing you'll do to define the culture moving forward in the short term and the long term for that company and for you.
One of the other things, though, that I want to raise is, we'll call it situational for CISOs. The Heidrick & Struggles does an annual CISO survey, which, one, the fact that a major employment and placement firm has that kind of focus on CISOs tells that the role is quite, you know, has become quite significant in business. What's that?
It's not transitory is what you're saying?
Exactly. But great words, because what it is the things that this year's survey talk about is that it is terminal, that the role is still terminal. You get to be a CISO, you do it, and what do you do next? You go to be a CISO again at another organization. Inside the study, and again, I'll link to the PDF in the show notes, is a metric that a significant portion of CISOs coming in are coming laterally from another CISO role. So what, as people are not yet done with their careers, they're going to come in and they're going to do what worked for them before. So which came first, the CISOs making lateral moves or companies wanting to take your success and restamp it at the next place? Which, you know, how does this play in to this perpetuation of bring in your own team, recreate the success you had at the last place?
Well, I think about it, if you look it through that lens and we say that the CISO is a terminal position, so therefore it's, I forget what the average is right now for the tenure of a CISO. So if we make the argument that a CISO is going to go and a CISO brought in their whole team, from a company perspective, from an overall risk perspective, do you really want that CISO? Because that means not only are you going to lose that CISO, you lose their team once that CISO moves on. Because a leader that takes his team with you is going to leave a void when they go to the next place. It's like locusts, right? Eat up the whole field and there's no field left, and then on to the next one.
But the thing there is, so first of all, the metrics I've seen, and this, I guess this calls all metrics reports into question in this field. The metrics I've seen when talking with colleagues and working with colleagues is that CISOs are not leaving in the 20, it's now edging up near 24 months on the official numbers scale.
Okay.
But we're staying way longer than that. At least the ones I know. Maybe I don't know the CISOs that are jumping around every 8 months to offset the fact that most I know are 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years in the role.
Right.
That said, there is, I think institutional organizations are starting to get past the idea that, or they're building their organization such for that kind of more increased churn that you're seeing it in every role.
Dan, I was just going to throw this in. It could be from the VCSO role that we talked about in Fake It or Make It.
Well,
maybe they're bouncing around more and it's bringing the average down.
Well, exactly. And I think it's actually due to the diversity. So those of you who listened to this episode that didn't listen to two episodes ago, go listen to that one on the role of the VCSO in the world and what it takes to be a CISO. But you went right where I was going with this CISO title. Now let's take the VCSOs out of it. Even in the fully employed W-2 and its equivalent around the world type of employment structures, the people who are in the CISO roles vary widely from 25 year. And this is also, by the way, in that Heidrick & Struggles report. It's really interesting. Also helps with some salary information, what things are, where around the world. The 2021 and 2022 versions are really great. But you see this range of experience, exposure, fields, number of previous jobs, who you report to. I mean, all of this means that the title of CISO varies widely. There isn't a common right. definition of what it is and does. And therefore, you have those with this definition of CISO that have broad exposure across organizations, across different fields, can come in and can do what they need to do, spend a lot of time, study the things. They're likely change CISOs and then go out. And then you have others that are more run CISOs. And so those have a longer. And then you have those that are CISO because we were told we needed to have a CISO, but we don't necessarily know what that title fully entails. And those might be the ones where either the company doesn't know what they need in the role, the candidate, the person in the role, can't fill what the need of the company is, or it's so variable that that person gets frustrated and leaves. So those could be things about the churn, but either way, the likelihood, according to this, is this, and it was 64%, I think, will go on to be another CISO. So we have to go somewhere, right? So let's go to us and bring in our own team. But it's not the fact that you have a position, it's what you do with it. Do you right. take the teams that are there? Do you grow your own? Do you go out and hire and bring in new faces into the environment, new perspectives? So why don't we talk about that one? Oh, go ahead, Aaron.
Yeah, I was going to say some of that probably depends, right, too, on, I mean, if we go back and I forget which episode it was, we were talking about the Forrester report and the different types of the personas of the CISO, right? That we all have different areas that we perform, the different scenarios that we prefer to be in. Not all of us want to be the ones that are just going to continue to run it once it's built. Some of us are builders, some of us are runners, and I know there's more granularity to it, but I think there's a component of that. And I would venture to guess, I mean, there's nothing more behind this than just my thinking on the fly here, is that you start to see certain leadership types of bring your team stack up against some of those personas. That if somebody is coming in and to turn around, it's build from the ground up, that there's probably a higher propensity of bring with you the known commodity to build up the organization, to get it stood up and then transition on and build somewhere else.
Right. But I've seen this from some organizations I keep an eye on. You know, new CEO arrives, and within a year, the commentary is, oh, they are trying to recreate this, their last organization, and they brought nine SVPs over from that organization, and it literally looks just like. And I feel like that happens more than I'd like to see it happen.
That's like one of the worst things that happened from the era of General Electric. And everyone looking back and saying, well, look how fast, or look how GE grew, right? In that time period in the S&P, if you invested in anybody, I think it's like over 70% of the stocks you could have invested in basically did the same, right? It was a time period of very high growth, but for the size company they were in their growth, it was, well, how did you do that? And when they went back and looked, like trying to apply SMART goals, right? Like you had all these short-term goals. It was very easy for people to come up with goals that they could reach, right? But it was those long-term goals, those stretch goals that they didn't really have. I use that as an example because the amount of management that went from GE to other companies and came in with the mentality of, well, if you need to shore up cost in the short term, we'll just fire people. All right, we can lay off X number, we'll reduce down our overhead, reduce down some of our fixed costs, boom. And then
the last 2 months in business surely has shown us that we moved on from that idea, hasn't it?
Right.
And again, like the example from a CEO standpoint, you come in and you're bringing in, I don't want to use the word cronies, but you bring in people that you worked with before.
A cohort.
Cohorts,
a leadership cohort. How about that?
The way we've worked together before, you know,
so much sounds so much nicer that way.
But I look back at Alan Mulally when he came to Ford, right? Allen didn't come in and say, I'm going to bring my Boeing team in with me. But right. what he did say was, I'm going to bring my culture with me, the way I like to do things. And that's transparency. And just trying to get people to give them a report that showed some red on it, right? And just so you guys know, they don't do these reports anymore. They kind of went to the wayside because as things got better, they were like, well, we don't really need to do it. We won't report it to the president anymore or the CEO. We're just going to report it down to this level. And then from there, the maturation happened and it gently now it's like, yeah, we give these reports to managers. So what happens? It's not being fed up to this person, right? This person who really cares. That was one thing that in the Toyota investigation, and that's auto reference number two, in the Toyota reference when
oh, there's been more than two, Brian.
Next is ISO 9001. It's coming.
Yeah, but when they were having the was it the Camrys that weren't braking right and the vehicles out of control, et cetera, and there's so much that went into what was real and what wasn't. But what was really apparent when Akio came over here and talked in front of Congress, and he went back and told the entire team this, was they created a buffer layer where what is important that should be told, what are we telling them and what are we not, right? That you become a little bit insulated in this position as the company grows and people start to wonder, what things do I tell them and what things don't I tell them, right? And it's not because he said, this is what you need to tell me. There's circumstances that you're not going to know about. This all goes back to, Dan, when you were talking about the people you bring in. So I was using Mullally as an example of, he didn't bring in his own team. What he brought with him was culture, and he helped change a company at a time when things were very bad and to right the ship, if you want to call it that. And it's not easy. And Eric, going back to small giants, it's much easier to turn a dinghy, right? And it's much easier to turn a small sailboat. But I think the Suez Canal was a great example of what happens when you have a massive ship that somehow gets beached and loses power. It is almost impossible to turn that ship and get it moved out of the way in a short period of time. It's a long period of time. And with that will come losses. But if you can stick together and from a culture standpoint, build on that, great things will happen. So people matter. So the con to coming in as the CEO or the CISO that's going to bring in all your own people, again, going back to culture. But if the company wants results and they want them fast, and part of you coming in is you have to deliver, then already the culture that you're bringing in is you're somewhat scared, some trepidation, and you're worried about delivering. And when you start to fear things, self-preservation, what are you going to do? You're probably going to reach out and pull the people in that you trust the most, that are going to go to war for you and try to hit numbers or some type of whatever your metrics are, right? Because they've worked with you before and they know how to do that.
In an attempt to take back my own phrase, the whole approach, it depends. it depends on the situation. And I don't think any one of these paths is the unilateral path, or should be the unilateral path. Two things. One, I was given I wish I could remember the context, but it applies in so many things. Speed kills. It, not just cars. That was not actually an auto reference. It was about execution in an organization. The faster you jump to making large scale change or thinking you know what's going on before making decisions, you end up with a much larger potential for failure on the other side. So, you know, the idea of despite the organizational push or drive or need for quick results and swift, decisive, and visible action, I think there's something to be said for the strength of the leader to be able to say, look, we need to sit and listen and understand the organization first. We need to understand what's going on before we can make these kind of wholesale changes, because we can make the changes, but then we realize in 6 months that these weren't the right changes because we didn't understand the situation well enough. And then we have to do it again, and we've lost 6 months. Now there's a potential risk, high risk, high reward. You could make that risk, and maybe it was the right decision, and you come out with a very big reward. But there's also a very good likelihood that that's not the case. And you know, the idea of the there was an article, and I'll see if I can find it and put in the show notes, was about the, just from the other day, that the best skill that a CEO can have or learn is that of learning listening.
Mm-hmm.
That you listen, you shut up, you say, tell me what's going on, and you listen. And you listen in a way that you listen in a way that people know you're listening, active listening, but also listening for information and being able to put together that situation. That applies to every executive. And I think that's critical before coming in day one and saying, guess what? Day two, I'm bringing in my own squad. Before you understand the capabilities of the people there. Because you might lose the people that know, you know, you might not just lose the people that know the stuff. You might lose the people that could actually fit the exact model you need to be successful down the road. And they were there under your nose all the time. I think this is this kind of pause, this kind of cautious moving forward is, you know, is a trait I look for in leaders. But it's also, one that can easily be exploited, or not exploited, overstated, overdone, overanalyzed, analysis paralysis. We sit and listen and listen and listen, and I still need more. But we don't act. You get 12, 18, 24 months in, and you still haven't done anything because you're still listening and learning. Well, at that point, that's a different story.
Yeah. And I think it's pretty clear now from the three of us where we stand on our leadership styles and the leadership styles that we aspire to follow. But I mean, asking the fundamental question, though, are there times when you do need a whole crew change out, and that CEO that comes in and the changing of the guard is a good thing? I would make the argument, to answer my own question, that there are times, and I'm going to pick on like a Wells Fargo, right? If you go back and what was going on the culture of kind of creating fake accounts, fake upsells, all of that, I think there are probably times when a message needs to be sent that the culture we have is wrong. We need to change now. You may not have that 6 months to, well, let's listen, let's understand how we got here. No, you got to send a message now. So I think there, as you kind of started out, Dan, that it depends. I think there are those times when that may be necessary to put the paddles to the organization, give it a jolt, and go in a different direction.
Got to yell clear first. Clear! No, I think so. And the answer, there's no clear-cut single answer. Some cases call for more dramatic decisive action. Some call for caution and caution and timeliness.
So Dan, you took on a new role as a CISO of an organization.
Mm-hmm.
Since you've been there, what was the process? Because it's been about 4 months, 5 months, 6 months?
Six
months. Gosh, time flies. So you've been there 6 months. What was, and I'm not asking for the play-by-play in terms of, you know, here's the first projects you were working on, but from a thought process, when you came on in, and I think you're probably in a different scenario because you had actually worked with the company for a period of time. So you were very familiar with some people that had worked there, what some of their strengths were, but
mm-hmm.
also though, because the company also does acquisition. So you have new people coming on. How do you handle that? Right. Cause that's kind of, you know, this is relatable to a lot of companies, and Eric, where you previously worked right at Penske, right? Growth through acquisition, you acquire a company, they actually have a security manager, right? Or somebody. How do you integrate that person into the team? What's the process that you went through?
Yeah, I mean, well, I started with listening. You know, I had the luxury of both time and support to do so, to understand the business. And I think that being in a CISO role is, well, I look at the CISO role as 60% business, 40% technology, and continuing to shift. We have technologists. Luckily, we're a software company, so we have very good technologists in each of our product areas, and that most of them have had to understand security to some extent already. So I had, you know, but how did I find this out? I talked to them. I listened. I understood and saw where we had gaps, and where we had gaps. I brought somebody in that had worked for me before to fill one of those gaps. It wasn't something we had the ability to fill from an internal. It was a gap area. And so brought somebody in, and that's, you know, that's going well. But in other areas, my intent is to go out and go to the street and say, look, bring me everybody, you know, that you all know, submit, I want to see fresh faces for some of these things. When I go out and look at technologists at, you know, cloud security architects and application security architects, other things, I want fresh views. I want certain prior experiences because I need that, but it doesn't need to be prior experience with me. I think there's a lot to bringing fresh view into the organization on how to approach things. In the same way, I like to think I brought fresh views into the organization on how to approach things. And my view, I'll never admit this to my kid though, is not always right.
Oh, come on.
What?
I think it depends.
I love that concept of fresh views because I truly believe there's something we can learn from everybody. You know, I've always tried to take this mentality in life that every experience that you have is an opportunity to learn, right? You can either learn that, hey, I didn't like this, so I don't want to incorporate that. I don't want to be like that. I'm going to avoid that in the future. Or I did like that. I'm going to mimic this. This is who I want to become. I'm going to add that to my arsenal. It's another tool in my toolbox. And I think that's the right mentality. And I think that's a key one from a leadership perspective, that if you go into an organization and the key, Dan, is what you were saying on listening, that you find that opportunity to learn from everybody that you come in contact with, because none of us have it all figured out. This world is changing so quickly.
I'm sorry, I wasn't listening. The world is changing quickly. Sorry. My joke jumped on your valid statement.
And Eric, the world is changing quickly too, even on, like, you look at the vendor side. With economy slowing down, and we were talking about layoffs, right? It's not just, you know, temp workers working in manufacturing at auto suppliers that are being let go right now. It's all the recent hires for hyper growth SaaS security and IT companies, right? That prior to March had these really lofty goals that they were going to accomplish this year. So what did they do? Well, we got to go from 30 million to 60 million. So we need to double the number of sales heads that we have. And we need to go out and push. And some of those companies that have had layoffs have just been kind of slaughtered behind the scenes in conversation and so forth, regardless that some of them came out and said, hey, we need to take a cautious approach, that it's not about growth at all cost, right? You go back to being small giants, Eric. It's very hard to be a small giant in the security world. It's, you know, marketing bling here. We are the greatest and solve all problems. I actually thought it was really funny. I don't know if it was Chris Roberts or somebody else that posted it. It wasn't Chris. It was somebody else that basically said, check it out. It was a CISO, and Chris is a CISO now, but it was a CISO who said, check it out. If we bought all four of these products, here's what I learned at Black Hat. If we bought all four of these products, I can stop all breaches. I can stop ransomware. And he put up like four pictures basically that he took of marketing presentations or et cetera. And he just, it was one of those funny moments, right? Where there isn't four things that you can buy that are going to stop everything that you do, right? But these companies from a growth standpoint kind of had to pull back. And some of them said, we can't grow at all costs. And people got laid off. And what would I do, you know, if I came into a sales organization and I was told, hey, Brian, you're going to be our sales director, our sales VP, and here's what our goals are for next year. And we just did, let's just say, throw an arbitrary number out there. We just did $100 million. Next year, though, we need to do $200 million. Here's the number of salespeople that we did it with this year. You need to put a plan together of how to get to $200 million, right? Well, okay, let's take a look at those areas where we did the most sales. Right? And what was the number per person, right? What does the territory look like? You break it down and say, well, here's how many heads we could put into each one of these territories. And I think people would still kind of be successful. Here's what we could do in Europe, et cetera. And then from there, you say, okay, now we got to hire people. First thing I probably do is ask the people that work there in that area, hey, if we were to hire another person in your state, who's somebody you would recommend that you think you would work well with in the state? Like, that part's important also, right? Maybe there's people out there, and maybe I'm being too high in believing that people are going to do the right thing and actually put together like, hey, here's someone I would like to work with, right? Maybe they're not going to give you anyone for 2 months because they're trying to drag their feet because they want to hold everything to themselves. Who knows? But then that leads to the last thing I do. And in certain areas, be like, hey, I know someone that's really good. I probably ask that person I know to go take lunch or get together with the person that already works there in that state. Right. Because he's probably going to come back and be able to tell me things like, hey, you know, so I met with John, you know, who's been working there for 2 years. Although he said he's done really well, there are certain things he doesn't like. Right. It's like, really? Yeah. He kind of put me on the cautious side of maybe this isn't the right organization for me, Brian, or some things need to change. Like, that's also great feedback. And you're probably not going to get that right away on a one-on-one when you're the new boss.
Right.
Well, go ahead.
And I think it's important to remember, you highlight this point. People also change what interests them and what they're after in life.
Right.
Just because we were good together and we did this then doesn't mean that that all six of the people that I think I want to bring over also still want the same thing as we did at the last three times we did it. Well,
and that's what I think about. We talked about it one time that the this era has been coined the big resignation. And I don't buy that. That I think it's the great realization that I think we've seen a major shift in what matters to people. And that is people are redefining that for themselves, which is a great thing. And to go back to kind of where you started, Brian, I think one of the key things you were talking about when you were talking, you're starting to get into market segmentation, right? You're understanding the target markets for an organization and when setting objectives. And I think this is one of the key things with leadership and as it ties to people is how those objectives are set, right? That if we see the sales, now granted, I haven't been in a sales organization, but I would think that if we feel that sales objectives are just set by purely throwing a dart on the wall, well, we've seen the run rate, so therefore we're going to set the, you know, next year's sales that you have to hit this, that it would be akin to organizations. And I know Gartner warned about this, as organizations were looking at COVID and going back to the office, and they said that if you just arbitrarily pick the number of days, you miss the point. Right? There has to be something more behind it. Right. And that something more behind it is listening. It's having a conversation with the people. How are people feeling? What is the market that we can actually target? What are the numbers that are actually feasible, right? Because it's very, and I would imagine, Brian, this is very different that if you're looking at trying to sell into a Midwest company that from my perspective is very much about relationships, and it's a longer sales cycle versus something out on the West Coast, that your numbers and your targets are going to be very different based on understanding the people that have the relationships in that market and where the numbers should be set.
There's a ton of truth to that. I actually remember the previous company I was at talking to some of my guys on the East Coast, like my buddies in New York and stuff. And when we get on our own calls together, I'd be like, hey guys, turn your cameras on. And one of them joked, he's like, dude, Schneebs, you are so... you know, you are that people person. Like, everyone have your camera on. I'm like, you don't try to get everyone in your meetings to turn their camera on. He goes, dude, this is New York. Nobody turns their camera on. I go, I bet at the end of a call, if you said, hey, why don't we get everyone to turn their camera on and we'll do a quick send off. He goes, no, that's so dumb. And I'm like, believe it or not, people would turn it on. There's a little bit of personal there. Like you get to know people. And he's like, listen, dude, this is different. Right. So to your point, each area is different. I need to give one quick shout out though. While we were having this conversation, Za actually had texted me and talk about like such a perfect, you know, segue to somebody goes into a new organization and do you bring your own, right? She joined a new organization. I didn't get a moment to actually ask her. So quick question, did you bring a bunch of people with you to your new location? But I can't wait to have the conversation because I said I was actually on with you guys recording and she goes, oh my gosh, tell Dan and Eric I said hi. She goes, just so you guys know, my husband's now a listener too. I'm like,
nice.
Oh, this is so great, right?
Shout out to
this
Zah.
By the way, this is Zah Gonzalvo, who was here in Michigan, now in Puerto Rico, working for Banco Popular.
That's correct. Yep. Dan, thank you. I'm sitting here just throwing it out there. Like
you're big with the first, having just finished editing a few episodes, you're big with the first names. I'm going to be big with getting people those second names.
Yeah, no, but Eric, totally true. And each area you go to, and I think the larger the company you go to, right, as a CISO, and Dan, for you, you got people in different locations, right? Whether it's over in Europe, whether it's on the East Coast and West Coast that you're working with, that also means that culturally, not just the person's culture, but from a company culture on different sides of the US and different sides of the globe is all very different. and trying to make that, you know, all, you know, gel together sometimes can be tough, but it's understanding those things. It's the listening, right? That help define how you go about your approach.
Right.
And I was trying to think, there was in the 20-30 things I threw off in the very beginning of the episode, you know, how to come full circle on some of them. We talked about, do you bring your own pros and cons? And I think we kind of hit on that. I don't know that we debated, you know, one versus the other. I think it's a mixed bag given the scenario you're walking into. We also kind of talked about the difference between vendor organization versus an enterprise CISO role, right? Like, and I think that also is relatable to the fact that CISOs deal with vendors all the time. So as you watch a company that you are working with grow, you personally get to see the culture change and who you're working with, right?
Right.
And I also think, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I do want to add though, because I feel like we turn this into a bit binary, right? That it's either don't bring your team or bring your team, right? But I think Dan actually touched on something early on, that if you think about organizations going through change, right? It's sequential hills that are all connected. From a leadership perspective, and I'm gonna draw it back to Jack Welch, and I know this kind of elicits some different emotions based on views of his style.
Don't do it.
Yeah. And the one of the comments that he made about get the right people on the bus. I do think that we do have to keep in context of where the organization is going, that if the wrong people are on the bus, you need to do, it's doing them a disservice. We're dragging them along the way in a bad environment that's not suited for them. There is a leadership perspective that if somebody's not fitted for where you're going, that to help them transition is a key part of leadership. And we've got to make sure that we focus on that.
And I should also say that I'm not anti Jack Welch, right? Because I think some of his philosophies, and just like what you just said, are right. The context that people have used GE as the example, right? Yeah. And pull, it's things get lost in interpretation, right? And this is how people begin to interpret it. The same thing, not, you know, how people interpret certain religions. It's the same thing. Like they take this and they say, hey, this is the playbook. And then it's how that playbook gets interpreted and how people then. But at the end of the day, it does come down to scenarios, circumstances, people. There are, I mean, I even admitted that if I was put in place as a VP, there's part of me that in different locations, I would be trying to bring in people I know that have done a good job, right? People I believe I can trust. The first thing is making sure that the people that are already there are comfortable with the people you're bringing in to an extent, right? That these cultures fit. Because the worst thing that could happen is you bring people in, you have a culture clash, and instead of hitting your numbers, now neither are, and people are pointing fingers. And then that really points back to you.
I've always looked at it, if you're bringing in somebody that you already know, that it's a conflict of interest if you're doing part of the interview process, right? That from a leadership perspective, you almost have to recuse yourself, and then it's up to the team. If it's a fit with the team, then they are making that decision.
Here's the scary part there, Eric. If I already know, if I'm on your team and I already know this person's a friend of yours because I've been told by five people, when I do the interview, this is a rubber stamp. Yeah, go ahead, Dan.
Continue.
I interviewed someone at a previous location, and when I came back and said this person wasn't good, I was not invited to any future interviews.
I think that speaks more about the person who didn't invite you back than about you. Robin, because we're just about out of time. In that case, do you tell people that this person is a relation, a friend, or a previous colleague when you have them interview your candidate? Eric?
I would, because from my perspective, I would rather be fully transparent, because I feel like if it's found out after the fact, it's going to look like I withheld pertinent information, and that reflects badly.
Brian?
But then, so it's a double-edged sword. Then when people know that, they're like, oh, this is Eric's guy, and if I don't give him the stamp, if I'm one of the two people that have to do kind of the yes, we can work with them, I still would tell him, but I tell him, hey guys, this is somebody I know. This is where I think he's got, you know, some strengths. This is where maybe he's got some weaknesses, where you guys have some better strengths. Feel it out. Let me know your overall thoughts. right? But make sure they feel safe that whether they say yes or no, knowing when they go into it feeling safe in it, it's like, okay, like if I don't really like this person, I can let my boss know, like, this is why, right?
Boss or colleague or somebody else. I'm of two minds. The scientific mind of mine says double blind studies work for a reason. Nobody should know all the things, but then I'm also a transparency person. So I generally let all people know I have a previous relationship. I have previous work with this person, et cetera. And with that, we've come to the end of another great security debate. Thank you, Eric. Thank you, Brian. And thank you, listener. We really appreciate you being here. We also love your feedback. Email us feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net. You can find us on Twitter @securitydebate. You can find our YouTube channel. Yes, we have YouTube. If you want to watch the faces I make as Brian makes yet another automobile reference, or Eric quotes yet another book, or the faces they make when I interrupt them with a joke that isn't really funny. You can find us on YouTube by searching Great Security Debate. Give us a subscribe. Give us a like. I'll be that YouTuber. Yes, like and subscribe. Like and subscribe. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again soon on the next Great Security Debate.